Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this, you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Unless you're doing a creative writing course where someone's forcing you to write, people fall away in droves. I think it's because the way that we analyze literature, we don't think about the sucky first draft. I think that's one of Anne Lamott's greatest gifts to the creative world is the phrase, the shitty first draft. Yeah. It's easy to say it, And it's easy to understand intellectually that you need to do that. But doing it is really hard. Allowing yourself to write something that's imperfect and to keep going to the end and to say, you know what, this opening is terrible and the middle's a mess, but I'm going to get to the end of this short story and I'm going to figure out what it's about.
Yeah.
And I can come back and edit it later. And it's the practice of doing that over and over again is the only thing that allows you to do it again. Mm-hmm. Like, I've interviewed best-selling novelists and for articles and stuff, and they all tell me the same thing. They're like, you know, I always reach a point where I think I can't do it. And when I say, how do you get over it? They say mostly it's because I've done it before.
Yeah. I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Julie, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I came across your story because you wrote in about Story a Day, which we'll talk quite a bit about over the course of our conversation. But I was really intrigued by what you're up to. But before we get into all of that, as you know from having heard the show, I never like to start by asking somebody about their work. And I thought, you know, given your accent, I knew this is where I want to start. And that is, where in the world did you grow up? And what impact did where you grew up end up having on the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career?
Oh, I love that question. I quite often will start when I am in a room with people, I'll start by saying, I was born in Scotland, because they get distracted by my accent. And it's a little bit all over the place now because I've lived in different places. So I was born in Glasgow in Scotland, and my parents very sort of almost immediately took me to the south of England, where I grew up in Surrey. So it's very nice, you know, near Sandhurst Military Training Academy and the Windsor Castle, which all the Americans have heard about now because you guys love royals. And so I grew up down there till I was about 10, and then we moved back to Scotland. So that was an interesting experience to have grown up in this very nice sort of the heartland of England, the BBC bit, right? The bit where you always used to think of that BBC accent and everything. And then to move back to Scotland, which I'd always felt like I was Scottish, but I didn't have the accent and I hadn't grown up there. And my parents, my whole family was from there. So yeah, it's kind of odd to have been in this sort of English public school, which is private school world, and then to move back to Scotland, to the west coast of Scotland, which is very green, right on the coast, but going into what Americans would call public school, and having to make that adjustment, and then going to a high school with a very wide catchment area. So there were kids from mining villages and kids from, you know, mansions. And during the 80s, when there was lots of industrial action going on and there were miner strikes. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think, and I found, and I was just having this conversation with some other writers in my community, it's really hard to write about the places where you live as an adult, because you never feel like you're from there the way that you feel like you're from a place that you lived as a child.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I'm. And now, of course, I should do the end of the story, is where I moved to Pennsylvania. I actually moved to Boston after graduating from Edinburgh University, because I was going out with a boy, and he was doing a year or two in Boston. And I was like, I'll come over for the summer and work. And so I did. And then we ended up getting married and staying, and he got recruited to come down to Pennsylvania. So it's been a long year that we were supposed to be spending here.
Yeah.
It's been, 25. So.
Wow. So, you know, the thing I always wonder, particularly about people who are immigrants to the United States, is how they integrate the two cultures, and also, you know, what are the contrasts that you witness? You were educated in another country. I don't know if you have kids, but I always wonder also like how you think about education when you've been educated in another country, and you contrast that with the United States. And also the other part of this I always wonder is how you preserve certain aspects of culture and heritage. And you know, I think in particular, when you don't, when your parents, if you're an immigrant, like an Indian immigrant, or, you know, many of the others we've had here, when they don't necessarily speak English as their first language, mm-hmm. I think language is the very first thing to go when it comes to preserving heritage and culture, because of the fact that we grew up here. Like, I know for a fact, if I don't marry an Indian girl, the first thing to go will be language.
Yeah. And that's funny because I married a Scottish guy. So before my kids went to school, they did talk with Scottish accents because they sounded like, you know, they learned to talk from us. So they had these little Scottish accents, and then they went to school and like almost immediately dropped them. But I had been through that myself with my parents having taken me to England. And I grew up with an English accent as soon as I went to school. And then very quickly when we moved back to Scotland and went, I went to school there, and like within 2 weeks, my English accent was gone because that was just not going to work. As someone, I've only recently embraced the term immigrant. I always kind of shied away from that because I hadn't really ever made the decision to emigrate. I sort of married a guy that I liked and ended up living here, and I like it here. But it's only been in the last few years that I've sort of embraced that label, and I became a citizen in 2011, and even then, I didn't embrace the label immigrant. And so, but I do think about, you think about when you're raising kids here, there are things that you're just, your outlook is different. So that stuff's always going to be in the home. I think we're a little more laid back than a lot of American parents. We're much more keen for, and a lot of American parents are like this too, but the prevailing culture in the Northeast Mid-Atlantic region that I'm in is fairly helicoptery. And we're not like that. We're much more, you know, well, you go out, you make your mistakes, and you figure it out from there. So we're not as hung up on grades and stuff, because we would rather our kids, you know, make mistakes and figure things out. But it's education is kind of a big thing for me at the moment, because I feel like I'm overeducated. My husband's overeducated. He's got a PhD, did a postdoc. So we're those overeducated people. And I feel like I'm floundering the whole time. Ever since my kids stepped out of the house and went to kindergarten, I just feel like I don't know what I'm doing because the system is so different here. And now I've got a kid going into his junior year, which I've only just learned to call it that. My eldest is going into junior year, and everybody's talking about college, and I'm like, I just don't even. Somebody said to me last night, oh yeah, I did my history degree and I did a politics minor because I realized I didn't have to do a 300 level politics course. I looked at her and I said, I have no idea what that means, and my kid is going to college. Like, I am just asking everybody. I'm crowdsourcing my kids' education decisions because it's been fantastic for me as someone who was always academic and always bright. You know, I always thought that I had to figure things out for myself. One of the things I have really enjoyed about moving to America has been that if I don't know something, it's not, you know, I've got license now to say, you know what, I don't know. I just don't know this stuff. Can you help me? And that is not something I was good at when I was younger. So that's been very freeing for me. And I'm basically, you know, asking everybody all the time, I don't know about that. Tell me. Yeah. And it feels great.
It's funny when you describe that. Like, I remember, but you know, my friend Sarah Peck, who has two young kids, who's been a guest here on the show multiple times, is going to be a speaker at our conference. I remember it asked her a lot about parenting because I don't have kids, I'm married. And she's like, yeah, parenting is just this giant shit show. Basically what you do is you tell this kid, hey, we're going to screw you up. And your job is to go spend years in therapy fixing all the things that we screwed up about you. And I loved that moment because I thought it was so raw and honest.
It's interesting that she figured that out with young kids, because I don't think I figured that out until they were in early teens and they were starting to like really come back with their own impressions of you, and they'll tell you what they think of you, and you're like, oh, okay, all right.
Well, I mean, don't even hear me started on being a teenager. That to me is like the worst, you know, part of being a human, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's tough. I don't envy them.
Part about you that I never want to go back to.
And it's tough being a parent of teenagers because you empathize and you can remember it, but you still have to put the foot down sometimes and go, you know, that's not okay.
Yeah, You said something interesting about you being able to write about where you lived as a child because you feel like you're from there. And much like yourself, I moved a lot. And, you know, as a kid, like by the time I think I was finished with ninth grade, I'd been in seven different schools. Oh, wow. I lived in three or four different countries. Yeah. That's only because the town we lived in Texas, for some stupid reason, I got put in this year where every year we're in a different school. And then I think the year I got to eighth grade, they finally mixed sixth and seventh and eighth grade into one school. But, you know, and I was back there for the first time in 25 years. Sometime, you know, I think probably in April, you know, Texas A&M University, College Station, Texas, this small little town. And, you know, where my parents live now, for my sister, that is very much home. And I told my mom, I said, you know, when I go to College Station, I don't feel like this is a place we left. I feel like this is where I grew up. Like, this is home. Mm-hmm. Everything about it feels very nostalgic, where I don't have that feeling for where I actually ended up finishing high school, only because we were there for 3 years. But I think the thing that I wonder about is when you are living in a new place and you know, you're saying you don't, it's harder to write about. I wonder why that is. Like, what is it about, you know, that perception that we have that we don't notice things? Because I live in this like breathtakingly beautiful place, but I probably have written far more about College Station in my writing than I ever have about living in Encinitas.
It's a really interesting question because, like, I live in Pennsylvania and I'm a history major, so I was always kind of snooty about, you know, American history and how it's not very long before I came here. Mm-hmm. But once I got here, like, it's only 250 years, what are you talking about? Once I got here and I'm living in a small town that's an old steel town, and it was, you know, not too far from the Conestoga wagon trail. And, you know, there's a ton of history here, and there's a ton of history here, and there's a ton of families who've just lived here for generations. And so being someone who's a fan of accents and dialect and stuff like that, I'm very aware of the fact that I can't do the local accent properly, and it drives me crazy. But it also means that I don't know how to use the words, you know, the slang words. And I don't know if I was writing about teenagers, or if I was writing about even a woman my age who grew up here, I wouldn't know all the little things, like, where did you go on a Saturday afternoon? What was it like to be in sixth grade? I was never in sixth grade. I never went, you know, it feels like it would be more inauthentic in a way than to write historical fiction. And maybe it's just that I don't want to get judged by people who know that I'm wrong. Like, historical people who lived in the 17th century don't exist, and people who live in my science fiction fantasy worlds can't come and tell me I'm getting it wrong. But if I try and write about, you know, 2019 Pennsylvania, there's tons of people who can tell me I'm getting it wrong. So maybe it's ego. Maybe it's fear of getting it wrong and looking like an idiot. But I think it's also, it's just that stuff that you just don't know as much, because when you move somewhere as an adult, you're busy and you've got obligations and responsibilities, and you don't have all that sort of downtime to just sit and look around and try and get bored and fill your time with stuff and think deep thoughts. You're kind of running from one thing to the other a lot of the time. And that's, you know, why what you do and what I'm trying to do as well is important, to try and help people to create that space to just daydream again.
Well, I think that I notice it even in my town, especially because I'm about to move now. And I was thinking about all the places in 2 years that, you know, I've driven by 1,000 times. It was like, there's an Italian restaurant literally that is down the street from my house. I'd been meaning to check it out. I went there for the first time a week ago, and I've lived here for almost 3 years. And I thought it was so strange. And I remember we had this guest, Dave Vanderveen, who said that, you know, you have to keep changing these channels in your brain, because otherwise you get stuck in patterns you don't like. And he said that, you know, his dad told him, he's like, you know, I start every day by shaving a different side of my face, which I thought was really interesting, because we're pretty much stuck in patterns. Like, we take the same route to work. Mm-hmm. We go to the same coffee shops. I know this because this is me. Like, if you become a creature of habit. And I never realized how, you know, just those little changes of going somewhere you haven't been, like in your own town, suddenly make your own town this place of you know, discovery and creativity, no matter where you live.
Yeah, it's funny. I just read an article about people who don't sleep on the same side of the bed with their partner every night. And this created a huge stir. People were like, what are you talking about? And yeah, and then and we went away for the weekend and I realized my husband and I do that when we go on vacation. We swap sides quite often. Mm-hmm. But in our general life, you know, you've got your stuff and you, right. You got your stuff there and you want to know where everything is. And yep. It's the same. We go out for dinner. We go to the same restaurant all the time. We get into these patterns, but then you can go. And our little town actually is awesome because it's gone from being this really rundown steel town where the steel mill closed in 1987. Mm. And then there was like 10, 12 years of like really hard times. And it's being reborn as sort of like an artsy brew pub festival little town. And so during the year, there's a ton of little festivals they'll close off the main street for. And, you know, you can go down one Saturday and all of a sudden, you know, this street's closed off and you walk around and you're like, oh, wow, look, you know, I didn't even notice that little vintage clothing store, but they're sponsoring a flea market, so now I'm seeing it. And it's the town changes quite a lot around you, so it's one of the reasons I like living here, because it brings in different people and you see it from a whole new perspective.
Yeah, well, it's funny because, you know, we're having this conversation and people are like, what the hell does this have to do with what she does for work? So I wonder, you know, draw the connection for me about how, you know, all this brings you to a story a day.
Well, connections are all, yeah, writing is all about connections, and writing is all about putting new experiences together. I mean, the art in general is about holding up a vision of life that makes people look at it slightly differently and get out of those ruts and those routines. So for me, it's fantastic to live in a town like this because it gives me tons of material, and to live here, you know, as an immigrant and to be able to ask people questions, you know, why are you doing that way? You know, why do you go there? Why do you go to the shore every year? You know, what does that, why do people from this town go down to the Jersey Shore every year? I can ask those questions as a bit of an outsider. So what I do is I always wanted to be a writer. And I was failing and I had these two young children. And that is not it's a wonderful time, but it's not like an intellectually satisfying time if you're staying at home with a two-year-old and a one-year-old or a three-year-old and a two-year-old. So I was getting a little bit desperate and I wasn't making time for writing, which I know is something that feeds me. And I was trying to do all these other creative things like jewelry making, which I was terrible at, and knitting, which I'm all right at. But it wasn't, I was still sitting around daydreaming. And one day I had this revelation that if I was sitting around daydreaming, clearly I was still making up stories in my head and maybe I should write some of them down and actually have something to show for all this time I was staring out the window. But I couldn't figure out how to do it. I couldn't figure out how to give myself permission to take time away from this young family and my husband who was working outside the home. And how could I ask for time for my creativity, which wasn't going to bring in money? I just needed to be writing and I hadn't done it for long enough. You know, it'd been so long since I'd done it. So I was following lots of challenges online, Illustration Friday and 100words.net and NaNoWriMo. And I was kind of mad because I didn't feel like I could write a novel. And I was kind of angry that nobody had done anything for short story writers. Like there wasn't a month where you could do a challenge for short story writers. And as I sat there getting more and more angry about it, I thought, oh, maybe I should do that. So I did. So I said, I was frustrated for one thing that there was no community for short story writers and no challenge. But the other thing I was frustrated about was that I couldn't finish a single story. And in my brain, it seemed like if I couldn't finish a single story, then giving myself a challenge of finishing a story every day for a month would be much easier or make sense somehow. So yeah. I started telling people about it and they started telling people about it. And within about a month, I had about 100 people who had said, oh yeah, I'll do that with you. At which point I had to actually do it. So I launched this challenge in 2010 and I said, hey, story a day May, let's do it. And, you know, like I say, almost 100 people joined me and we just went and I slapped up a website and I started putting prompts up in case anyone needed them. And this community started to develop in the comments and in the forums that I had put up of people just like doing this writing that they had been putting off and doing it with abandon. And everybody was, so, every year it's the same. Everybody's really giddy at the beginning. They're like, I can't believe I'm going to try and do this. And then the first day they post, they're like, I did it. I wrote a story today. And it gets a little bit more difficult in week two. But once you get through that barrier, you've started to form relationships with other people who are doing it with you. And you've started to figure out, you know, what time of day works for you, how to get permission, how to give yourself permission, and how to inform the people you live with that you will be taking this hour to go away and do the thing. And by that point, the people in your life have started to notice that when you go away and do the thing, you come back downstairs and you're much happier and you're much easier to live with. And so if people can get to like the middle of the month and still be writing, they will make it to the end. And then they're just like, everybody's ecstatic. And you'll learn so much about your own patterns of creativity and how to make space for it in your life. It's just a fantastic experience. And I'm always so excited to see what people learn as they go through.
Yeah. I want to go back to this idea of giving yourself permission. I think that's a tough one for people.
Yeah, I
know this because I think that there are, you know, multiple aspects of giving yourself permission. And even Dani Shapiro wrote about this in her just breathtaking book, Still Writing, where, you know, she said giving yourself permission is one of those things that you have to do every day. And the funny thing is with something like writing, right, there's no sort of certification or, you know, you don't get a medical degree that says, hey, now you have a license to do this thing. And so I think there's this sort of, oh, who am I to do this? And one thing I always, you know, say is you have to give yourself permission to suck as well. Yes. And so I wonder, you know, what are the barriers that people run into with this? How do they get over them?
One of the reasons I wanted to do this month-long challenge is because of that, like the permission, it's finding a way to make space in your life for it, but it also the permission to suck is huge because anybody who's got the urge to be a writer probably has an experience in their life where they were writing stories, probably in elementary school or middle school or primary school or whatever you called it. And a teacher saw their story and went, wow, this is really good. You're a really good writer. And then you go into the upper levels of school and you start to analyze all the brilliant writers and you start to analyze the edited versions and published versions of their 14th draft of something and you critique it. And almost everybody I know stops writing around that age. And if you go and study at university, unless you're doing a creative writing course where someone's forcing you to write, people fall away in droves. And I think it's because the way that we analyze literature, we don't think about the sucky first draft. I think that's one of Anne Lamott's greatest gifts to the creative world is the phrase, the shitty first draft. And it's easy to say it, and it's easy to understand intellectually that you need to do that. But doing it is really hard. Allowing yourself to write something that's imperfect and to keep going to the end and to say, you know what, this opening is terrible and the middle's a mess, but I'm going to get to the end of this short story and I'm going to figure out what it's about.
Yeah.
And I can come back and edit it later. And it's the practice of doing that over and over again is the only thing that allows you to do it again. Like I've interviewed best-selling novelists and for articles and stuff, and they all tell me the same thing. They're like, you know, I always reach a point where I think I can't do it. And when I say, how do you get over it? They say mostly it's because I've done it before.
Yeah.
So, you know, giving yourself permission to suck is fine to say, but actually doing it over and over again is tough. So, yeah, I put a day together to give people a venue in which they can do that very thing. Like I say to people, you are not going to write 31 good stories. Mm-hmm. You might write one good story. You might write two if you're lucky. Yeah. But you'll write, you know, and I let people make their own rules. They don't have to write 31. They can decide to do three a week or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I say, you know, your stories aren't, write at a pace that sort of almost guarantees that you're not going to be able to write well, and it will be so freeing.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody knows I write 1,000 words a day, and I always say, look, I'm not a great writer. I just write a lot. Some of it happens to be worth reading. And I think that there's a really hilarious line in the movie With Honors with Joe Pesci where and Brendan Fraser, where, you know, Brendan Fraser is a senior at Harvard, and Joe Pesci somehow gets his hands on this kid's senior thesis. He's a homeless guy living in the, you know, basement of a library, and he starts throwing all the pages of the thesis into the fire. And, you know, Brendan Fraser is like, look, I'll give you whatever you want. And the Joe Pesci basically says, man, he's like, this stuff is really coming out the wrong end. and I, that always stayed with me. I said, yeah, that's why they call it a shitty first draft.
Yep.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I think
and quantity, sorry. Quantity. I was just going to say, you know, I read in, I think, Julia Cameron's book, the creative,
The Artist's Way.
Artist's Way. Thank you. You know, she says quantity. I think that was the first place I discovered this idea of I'll handle the quantity, the quality will follow. And I just hated that. I was mad at her. Like, I put the book down and I was like, what are you talking about? I'm a writer. I'm the one who's going to be making it good. And, you know, it was only when I surrendered to the idea that, no, you can't save it. You can't save up all your creativity and all your best ideas, because you get more creative when you're being creative, and you see the connections and you put the ideas together when you're actually doing the work, not when you're thinking about doing the work.
Yeah. What have been the kinds of stories that people have chosen to tell as a result of this? I really wonder, because you know, I mean, I think I've seen writing be this tool for all sorts of things. I mean, what James Pennebaker at UT Austin has done work around the fact that this can be an incredibly healing tool when you're at about painful experiences. So I wonder, what are the kinds of stories that people have told in your community?
We get all kinds of stories. And I don't require people to publish the stories anywhere because, you know, they're meant to be shitty first drafts and they're meant to, maybe they're going to brush them up and send them out to markets and try and get them published. And they have done, which is always thrilling. It's not the purpose of what I do, but I'm always thrilled when I hear that one of the stories has found its home. So I've seen some of the stuff that people do. And we get, I mean, everything is as many people as turn up are the different types of stories. And within that, you'll find people writing one type of thing at the beginning of the month and a totally different type of thing at the end of the month. Some people do use it for writing backstories for novels and for writing memoir. And some people are just playing and seeing what comes out. We get science fiction stories. We get really sort of painful personal tragedy stories. We get comedy and weird little creatures like the first year we did it, somebody told a story in tweets, which was pretty new at the time, and it was this story of somebody who was out in the wilderness, and the tweets were getting more and more, you know, desperate as time went on, and that was really fascinating to see that kind of thing. Because the wonderful thing about short stories is that you don't have to stick to the narrative form. You can, you can do all kinds of weird and wonderful things with them, and people do. Yeah. We get everything. We get everything from that sort of therapeutic memoir, digging into your past writing, to wild flights of fancy.
Well, I think Trevor Noah, if I remember correctly, literally published a book that was nothing but President Trump's tweets.
Oh, yes.
Which I think would be hilarious to read. But, you know, so I think that the other thing that really struck me about what you said when you wrote in was that many of these people aren't doing, you know, this thing for a living. They're just doing it for its own sake. And I want to talk about this because in one way, I feel that on some level, some of my work is a disservice to that narrative because of the people that I bring to the show who have all found a way to make a living off of their art. And in one way, despite writing a book, that's not necessarily always what's necessary. I definitely think that I've perpetuated this mantra to some degree that the art is only worth making if you are getting some sort of external result from it. And I don't think that's just limited to me. I think that a lot of the online world has created that narrative between books like The 4-Hour Workweek, and books like Escape from Cubicle Nation, like all these, and these are all friends of mine, like people who I've had as guests, people whose work I truly admire and look up to. But this is something that I've always wondered about is that, you know, this is a narrative that have perpetuated. And I think that a lot of people are not making their art because they don't think it's going to lead anywhere. And as a result, I think that we are missing out on a lot of really, really powerful creative work that doesn't exist because of that. And also for people, the kind of reward that would come from it. So I kind of want to turn that over to you and see, you know, what your view on this is.
Yeah. And we talk about this all the time in my community because we do all have, you know, we all need to pay the bills and we all want to be doing work that is meaningful to us. And for a lot of people, that meant because they were interested in reading and writing, a lot of them went into teaching, which is, you know, extremely admirable. It doesn't pay terribly well and it's long hours and things like that. So they're struggling with that, you know, taking time away from family and jobs to do their creative work. Mm-hmm. So I find that a lot of what I write for Story A Day is me sort of reminding people that we are more than just a collection of bills that need to be paid. We need to be filled. We need to do this work that we're here for. I'm lucky that I come from a country where the amateur was a strong part of the culture. Like everybody had a thing that they did. And it wasn't just, when I moved to America, I noticed that US parents tend to, US grown-ups, if they have children, tend to give over all of their interests in favor of running their kids to things. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I was growing up, and I think Britain's gone the same way a little bit too, but when I was growing up, there was a culture where everybody was you know, you had an interest and you'd go and take night classes, or you'd have your pot, you know, the men quite often would have their potting shed and their vegetable garden, and they would go and play lawn bowls. And it was just expected that you had lots of things that you did for fun and because you wanted to. Mm-hmm. And your job was funding your life rather than being your life. So that was a big cultural difference between where I grew up and when I grew up and the world that I live in now. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's still a little more like that in other countries, but I think that the US has this culture of go, go, go and earn and earn, and you can do anything you want to, but you got to work hard. And we do, I mean, when you meet someone and you ask them, what do you do? They tell you what their job is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's hard. It's hard to push against that culture and say, I'm doing this thing. And, how do you make money at that? People say to me, you know, how do you make money at that? And I'm like, well, now I run some courses and things like that. But, you know, for a long time, it was just something I did for the love of it. Mm-hmm. And as far as my short stories go, I mean, I write them and I put together little collections and I share them with family and friends. But I don't spend an awful lot of time trying to get them published by, you know, The New Yorker or by Shimmer Magazine. Or, you know, I don't spend a lot of time doing that because that's not what I'm in this for. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel really bad about that as the sort of figurehead of the community. I'm like, oh, maybe I should have more publication credits. Mm-hmm. And then I remember, you know, maybe I'm actually being a better figurehead if I don't have a lot of, you know, if I'm just doing this because this is something I am a better person because of.
Yeah.
But it's hard because you like I say, you're pushing against a culture that, you know, I knit and people will look at something I've knitted and they'll say, oh, you should sell those.
Exactly. Like,
do you have any idea how many hours went into this and how much I would have to charge for this? And, you know, just say it's nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I remember, I think it was on an interview with my friend Jordan Harbinger, who runs, you know, a very popular podcast that's been around for a long time, has a massive audience. And one of the things that he said, people don't have hobbies anymore.
you know,
they just have side hustles.
Professionalize it. You side hustle. Like, right, yeah.
You know, what happened to hobbies? You know, the things that we do just because we enjoy them.
Now, coming from a country where, again, you know, the amateur thing was lionized, but uh-huh. also work culture was very different. And it was sort of frowned upon to try and do too much and like to show off. So nobody had a second job. Mm-hmm. In Britain. And if you did, you were taxed like at the highest income rate on that second job, regardless of what you earned. So it was very much discouraged to strive. And so I'm thrilled with, like, I listen to Chris Guillebeau's Side Hustle School, and I'm like, mm-hmm. I'm thrilled that people who want to make a little extra money, it's out there for them and they can go for it. And there's tons of people who are sharing information about how you can do that. But my problem is, if you feel like you can't just have a hobby and you must have a side hustle. And yeah. that is the sort of prevailing culture that we've created. So I think you are standing up as a bulwark against that. So good.
Yeah. And, you know, the funny thing is it's also easy for me to say that, right? From my vantage point, somebody made this argument with me before and said, like, yeah, well, it's easy for you to say that considering you just got paid to write a damn book by one of the biggest publishers in the world. And then, you know, but somebody else made the point and said, yeah, but you did this long before anybody was willing to do that.
I was going to ask, how long were you doing this before you got to that point?
Like
before there was any promise.
Yeah. I mean, right? Years before there was any promise. Yeah.
And if it hadn't gone that way and you hadn't got the book deal, would you still be doing this?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, the thing is that I realized that, yeah, and everybody I talk to that I've sat as guests here, friends who have, you know, really just prolific bodies of work, most unanimously, it's like, you know, these people would be doing this thing even if nobody was paying attention because it wasn't about getting attention. It never was. And I think that to me is one of the blessings and curses of social media, is that this mm-hmm. thing has caused us to confuse attention with affection and attention with accomplishment. Whereas, you know, attention is a byproduct in my mind.
Yeah. And there's also the complicating factor of, like, I do believe that people creating art deserve to get paid for what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't want to say, oh, you should just do it for the love of it. Like if you're creating something that people want, you should absolutely get paid, and you should get paid fairly. You should get paid. People should think about like all of the ripples of in their lives of a fantastic book or a fantastic piece of art, and, you know, pay the creator in accordance with the value that you get from it. But you can't jump straight to that stage normally. And there's got to be, and it's got to be okay for people to just, like, my husband plays the guitar. He could play in a band. He's really good, but he doesn't. He does it for fun. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's okay.
Yeah. Like I said, I think we've, in one way, we've kind of complicated this narrative, because I think that people are like, oh, I get to listen to all this cool stuff. I get to discover all these cool people. I get to learn from them. And this is like, you know, a model of possibility. And yet, in my mind, those same models of possibility also create a great deal of dissatisfaction where there probably was none to begin with.
Or we just were good at shoving it down. Yeah. You know, I think about previous generations who had to work a lot harder than a lot of us for what they had. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't time. I mean, and it exists today. I'm not saying it doesn't exist today, but, you know, a lot of people don't have any free time. And there are phases and seasons in our lives where it's just really, really hard to find time for the work that, or I shouldn't even say work, for the activities that make us more fulfilled.
Yeah.
And it can be really hard. And we're lucky if we get to combine that with earning a living. But there's also, when you start to earn a living from the thing that was your avocation, there's a different relationship to it, which I don't know that people talk about enough. Mm-hmm. Like everybody talks about, oh, you should go professional. You should, you know, but when you go professional, it's no longer, you're no longer just creating it for yourself. You're no longer creating the thing that you want to and doing possibly doing your best work. You know, you're dancing, you're a dancing monkey for someone else. Whether it's your huge audience.
I
mean, or
I can tell you firsthand that once you get paid to do your creative work, it fundamentally changes how you do that work. You have to be very mindful about how you're being perceived in every situation. You know, like I remember I got some bad feedback from a speaking engagement. Granted, I got raving feedback from that same speaking engagement. you know, and that's kind of how it goes, I think, with feedback. But you kind of realize, you know, like I participated in this project where, you know, I was on TV, and I told people, I was like, look, I'm not in a situation where I can just speak my mind without consequences, even though our president doesn't seem to understand that, but that's a whole other tirade. You know, like I was like, look, when I say something, everything I say basically implicates every single person who's ever bet on me professionally, whether it's an investor, whether it's a literary agent, whether it's a publisher, because everything I do is a reflection of the choices that they make. So like, you're no longer in this position where your actions are only influencing the consequences of your life, but they're influencing everybody else as well. And I think that is one of the strangest things about getting paid to do creative work, because what got you there in the first place was not doing any of those things.
Yeah. And I've read a lot of interviews, and I've, you know, like I say, I've interviewed a bunch of writers, and they talk about that, you know, like being able to do your work for yourself and then having to do it, you know, in public is a very, very different beast.
Well, I think that's, you know, one of the things, you know, Audience of One, my other book was spreading very slowly, but then it kind of just picked up steam at word of mouth. And we've been doing very little promotion of marketing of this book. And for some reason, it just started, it seems to have struck a chord. And you know, I think about something Ryan Holiday said, that, you know, he said, you know, you want something that is a perennial seller. And he said also, if your happiness is dependent on how this thing sells, he said, that's a recipe for profound disappointment, because you're handing your happiness over to something to which you have no control over.
Yeah. There's a guy who writes and does podcasts, Mark McGuinness, who has a book about that, and it's about motivation for creative people. I think that's actually the title. And he talks about the difference between that extrinsic or external motivation, which is that which you have no control over, and the intrinsic motivation, which is the only thing that you can really the only thing you control. You, like, everything is like, my parents still say, oh yeah, when you have your bestseller, and I'm like, well, that's probably, you know, if I'm going to get rich from this business, it's not going to be from it's unlikely to be from a bestseller because there's just so much luck involved in that. You know, sure, maybe I'll write something and someone will make a Hollywood movie and it'll win Oscars and I'll get paid fabulously. But I'm not banking on that, right? Yeah. that's not, you know, my end result of, and that's not going to be my goal and the only thing that's going to make me happy.
Well, I think even for people who, like you said, achieve that, right? There's luck involved. And every, you know, I think it would be irresponsible for any one of us who's had this opportunity to say, oh yeah, like it's all due solely to my hard work and my work ethic and my artistic brilliance. That would be total bullshit. It's
not. You'd be a sociopath if you said that.
Yeah. I mean, I still to this day think it's incredibly lucky that an editor at Penguin happened to be browsing Medium one day and saw my article out of the hundreds of thousands she could have seen that day.
And the fact that like you graduated at that moment in time where, you know, a solid career wasn't necessarily going to fall into your lap. So you're, you know, it was a moment in time which gave you this opportunity to look around and go, well, what am I going to do? And, you know, how do I do it?
Timing, there's an amazing TED talk with Bill Gross, who's the founder of a startup incubator called Idea Lab. You might have heard of it. Some of our listeners, depending on how old they are, may not know it. But Idea Lab was basically where City Search, CarsDirect.com, all this stuff was born at Idea Lab. It was basically Y Combinator prior to Y Combinator and probably much more expensive to run. And of course, you know, it went bust sometime after the dot-com bubble because every one of their companies was one of these is dot-coms. But one of the things that he talks about in this TED talk, he gets on stage and he analyzed something like 250 startups. And he said there's only one common pattern between all the ones that succeeded. And he's like, what's that? Timing. Mm-hmm. Like the same company, if they had started at another time, wouldn't have been successful. Like, think about it. Why isn't Friendster Facebook?
You know? When I worked and during the dot-com bubble, I was right before it, I was working for a small startup and we did a thing where we were the first company to offer people print-on-demand services direct to authors. And it was, you know, it was a great idea. And I remember one day towards the end of my time there, after we'd had a big round of funding, but it just wasn't growing fast enough. And it was right before the dot-com bubble burst. And I remember my boss saying to me, you know, this is going to work, but it might not work for another 10 years. Yeah. And, you know, 10 years later, there's Amazon with CreateSpace and Kindle, you know, KDP. And you know, I look at it, I'm like, he was right. It was almost 10 years to the day that that really began to saturate popular culture. And of course they had resources and, you know, whatever else. But so some of this time.
When we started the podcast, somebody had said podcasting was dead.
Yeah, podcast blogs are dead, email's dead, everything's always dying.
Well, I mean, and you know, I'm very aware.
Dead. Nobody reads short stories.
Yeah, we're the beneficiaries of a 10-year head start. I mean, that's really all that is, you know, is good timing. But wow. So one other question for you about this. How has this creative outlet informed your parenting?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. It's kind of a circular thing, I think, because when my kids were not easy. They've never been sort of like mellow kids. So everything that we did has always been like you had to entertain them or you had to like keep them busy and keep them occupied, even potty training. And I have boys, so that's like notoriously harder with boys anyway. So I remember before I even started Story a Day, sitting, trying to keep my firstborn on the potty until he had done his thing. And the only way I could keep him there was to tell him outrageous stories, make up stories. And I used to have to tell them stories, try and get them to go to sleep, which they weren't a big fans of either. And we would go out for walks and like we'd walk into town because we're in this, you know, town that was just starting to revitalize. Excuse me. And we'd go for walks and we would be like, right, we're not taking the car, we're going to walk down. And they would start complaining. So we'd tell them stories and we'd be making stuff up as we were walking just to stop them from whining. So in a way, they informed my writing and they informed my creativity. And then I think that as a stay-at-home mum, it was important for them to see me doing something that wasn't just being mum. It was important for me to have them see me as something more than that. So when I started going away and you know, doing Story a Day and the first year, the first night, I sort of looked at my husband and I'm like, right, I'm going to go upstairs and I'm going to be writing and it's going to be like an hour and I don't want to be disturbed. And he's like, fine, go off you go. But for me to walk away from the family and do that felt like a big gamble. And then when I came back and they saw me again, everything was fine. And over the years, it's become something like they'll tell their friends that their mom's a writer, and they'll tell their teachers that their mom's a writer. And it's not like I have a shelf full of published novels, but to them, I am a writer, and they are storytellers too. So a couple of years ago, my eldest went away to a storytelling camp, which was just fantastic for me to watch. I was really jealous, actually. I was like, can I come? So they tell stories and they write in school. They're always happy when they're writing. They're also little scientists like their dad. But I don't know if the actual writing has informed the parenting. The act of writing has. Mm-hmm. You, as a creative person, you tend to be looking deeply at the human condition. Yeah. And so that's something that it's hard to be a hard ass parent when you're constantly thinking about all the variables. Like, well, you know, I understand why you're upset about that, and I understand why you're acting out about that. So yeah, I don't know. That's a really interesting question, but I think it's circular.
Wow. Well, this has been really, really, just wonderful. And I love conversations like this because, you know, there's no, like when I look at it, I'm like, okay, this is one of those conversations where everybody, I think, will take something very different from this. So I want to finish with my final question, which I know you've heard me ask, and that is, what do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Oh, I should have done my homework. I should have prepared something, shouldn't I? But what do I think it is that makes somebody unmistakable? Well, I think everyone, at the risk of quoting Monty Python, is an individual, right? Everybody is the sum of their life's experiences. And this is something I talk about with my writing community, because everybody worries about being original enough to create an original piece of art. And I say to them, you can't help but create an original piece of art, because every thought you have is the result of every experience that you've had in your life, every place you've lived, every friend you've had, every enemy you've had, every book you've read. The things that you hear in your head all day that you think are just boring, mundane, normal things, if you write them down, or if you paint them or draw them, nobody else has ever represented the world that way before, and nobody else has ever seen it represented that way before. So what makes somebody unmistakable is, I guess, giving themselves the permission to trust that their thoughts and their work and their ideas are good enough, have merit, can contribute to the world, will create ripples, and need to be heard. I always say to people, the world needs your story, because you're the only one who can tell it, and you're the only one who can do it that way, and nobody else has ever seen it before.
I love that. That has to be one of my favorite answers I've ever heard to that question.
Well, thank you. I think about this stuff a lot.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
Thank you. Yeah, this has been so much fun. And what such an amazing deep conversation. This is so great. Thank you for running this. But they can find more about Story A Day at storyaday.org. And we do two challenges a year, one in May, one in September. But there's stuff going on all year round, writing prompts and all kinds of stuff there. So that's the best place to find us. I'm also on Twitter at storyadaymay.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer.
Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.